Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona, we've been doing the show for over 7 years, which is a lot of experience and insight shared. But in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of disruptions. It started with the first round of regulation changes, and then COVID happened, which caused a lot of downstream and unforeseen interferences with the EB5 program. And now let's tack on litigation, program lapse, and of course, the EB5 Reform and Integrity Act. So my question is, what can regional centers and project developers do if their business operations, or better yet, their project raises to fund those business operations don't necessarily coincide with those external factors?
Yeah, you're so right, Mark. I mean, we call it the phase two scenario. I mean, a phase two scenario within itself can be complicated. And now you have to add RIA to the mix, RIA being the EB5 Reform and Integrity Act. Mm-hmm. So we thought that it would be wonderful to have someone on our show who really, truly understands all the complications involved. And I'd love to welcome you to our show, Sam Newbold. Welcome.
Thanks, Mona. Happy to be here. Looking forward to chatting with you today.
Sam, you've seen many different types of projects. I know that for sure, from direct pooled raises and, you know, construction, your usual type of operation projects. I mean, quite a mix, right?
That's right. I mean, anything and everything from just standalone operational projects to, you know, large scale real estate projects of different kinds, commercial, residential, infrastructure projects, public-private partnerships of all kinds, stadiums, airports, everything and everything under the sun.
Right, right. So as just stated as well, there's been so many reasons for disruptions from within EB5 over the last 2-3 years that there's a ton of projects out there who I believe just did not complete their initial raise. And by raise, I mean the amount of capital that they wanted to bring in.
Yeah, that's right. The program just fell off a cliff at the end of June 2021, you know, for regional center projects specifically. And things didn't get going again until, you know, March 2022. And that was a long downtime for projects where they weren't raising EB5 capital. And so there are many projects out there that were either right in the middle of raising EB5 capital when the sunset happened on the program, or they were just ramping up and now are having to kind of start fresh from what they were trying to do before the program lapsed in 2021.
Yeah. And Sam, you obviously have seen the same things with your projects. It's a different world out there from 2019. We're seeing changes in the budget because of the soaring lumber prices that they had during COVID, supply chain issues, which they've just sorted out, really. And they still, I'm seeing that in some projects, they're still having problems. And not to mention, of course, high interest rates.
Well, sure. Yeah, I think budget overruns were regular occurrences with the past few years, the supply chain issues making the cost of goods increase. So budgets were increasing as well. And construction timelines because of that, taking longer to get the hard materials to build projects all through that. Now we have a perfect storm with rising interest rates. So yeah, I think projects were taking longer. They were over budget. And that's contributed to some decisions about what to do with the EB5 components of these projects.
Right. And there's a number of issues that we really would like to discuss today relating to this, because it's not as easy and as straightforward as people think, right?
It's not. I mean, there's a lot to consider when thinking about picking up a previous EB5 raise. There's just a whole list of things to consider with that. And we're going to dive into some of those issues today.
All right. So I'm going to start with something that I know you have seen also. Projects that were stuck last year when there was no EB5 regional center program, but there was the EB5 direct pool program. So they have a direct pooled raise, and now they want to continue by adding on the regional center component. First issue, the job count. How do you approach a project if they come to you and say, look, we've managed to get 10 investors, but we need another 10, and we've got enough jobs for direct jobs for those 10 investors. How do we move forward?
Well, first and foremost, there are different types of jobs. You know, we can't do direct pooled raises anymore. But at that time, when we were doing direct pooled raises, you know, these were equity investments into the operating companies themselves or to holding companies that wholly own the operating subsidiaries. And those were actual, you know, headcount W-2 workers.
Yeah.
And that's why we call that direct pooled direct jobs. But in the regional center context, we're not necessarily counting those jobs the same way. But you do have to be mindful about how many jobs are needed to be created to support those investors in the direct pooled investments, and then how that impacts job creation and job allocation for investors who are investing in a regional center project, and you're going to combine those in the same project.
Yeah.
It's a really tricky formula. I've had conversations with economists about this, and I don't think there's a true consensus on it. But you do need to be mindful of trying to avoid double counting, or at least the optics that you might be double counting jobs by having these carve out calculations in the metrics when you're planning these things out in the business plans.
Well, the very first thing is being truthful. So we spoke with a project recently, which didn't even tell us that they had four or five people who they brought in under the direct pool program until much later. And then we went, wait a minute, this is double counting here, because we were using the same jobs in the economic report for the regional center program as we did with the direct pool. So I think, yeah, that's step one. So with regards to going forward with an economist, how do you suggest that they move forward with the direct jobs? Do they take them out altogether?
Sure. Well, I think you have to, if the structure of the EB-5 project that you're looking at is one where the JCE already has direct pooled investment and therefore is going to count W-2 jobs to support investors in the JCE.
And by JCE, we're talking about job creating entities.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're going to create a new NCE that's going to raise EB-5 capital and pull that together and deploy it down to the JCE as either debt or equity. I think you need to take into account what the needs of the JCE are first in terms of job creation, and make sure that those jobs are going to be accounted for and sectioned off from the rest of the business plan, and accounted for in your subsequent business plan for the regional center raise, because you're going to end up with two business plans, right? You're going to have a business plan that was related to the pooled EB-5 direct at the JCE level,
right?
And you're going to have another EB-5 business plan for the NCE that's raising the money through the regional center program. And they have to kind of complement each other. My advice, and these are the conversations I've had with economists, is that you just need to be much more conservative with your subsequent EB-5 raise under the regional center program to give yourself enough job buffer to cover for both and account for both. That way, you're not accidentally counting jobs, and you always have this rebuttable presumption by USCIS if they inquire about it later that, you know, look, these are conservative estimates, and we are taking into account the direct job creation that must exist at the JCE level for the first EB-5 raise.
And Sam, I think here again, it's really important to use an economist who really understands EB-5. There's some new economists out there, I've noticed, but I am very wary, because at least with our old economists, they understand RFEs and they understand how USCIS works. And I think they also are pretty conservative, most of them anyway.
Yeah, I think that has been the key with the passage of the new EB-5 law. We need to be conservative in the industry. And thankfully, we can be now. But one of the actual benefits, hidden benefits of the investment amount going up is that it has improved job creation buffer, which is the excess job creation that may exist for the benefit of the EB-5 investors in a deal. I think that generally speaking, projects and economists are being conservative now. And I think that's welcomed, because it's just, I think overall it's safer for EB-5 investors and for the market in general.
Okay, but how are you handling projects where, for example, someone has decided to pull out and they're being substituted by a new investor who now has to pay $800,000? So there's only $300,000 additional money in the project. Do we just leave it the same and have the same 10 jobs?
Well, I think you're asking questions that have not yet been answered by USCIS on these issues. And this goes to a fundamental question about how safe is it to commingle old rules with new rules and old offering terms with new offering terms in the EB5 space. It's going to be tricky. I don't think that there's an exact answer. And if we're talking about being conservative, well, obviously, I think some conservative advice would be don't do it, or try to find a way to have a separate offering, you know, under the new terms and deal with that separately. Because it's like we have two different sets of rules now under the old program with investors and the old rules. They don't necessarily blend well with the new rules in many respects. And we have to be mindful of that. And I don't think that there's going to be an exact answer for some of these issues for quite some time.
Well, I think you're absolutely spot on. I think it would have to be a new offering. And then they would, the regional center or project would have to see whether it was worth paying all the money that you now have to pay for a new offering just for an additional $300,000.
Right. I agree.
Yeah. So when we talk about a new offering, like a complete new set of documents, are we talking about a complete new set of documents? Can't we use some of our old documents?
Well, I've thought about this quite a bit, and I think it really depends on the type of project, the timeline for the project initially, where that project is right now when it's contemplating raising more EB5 capital. I have clients with projects that could potentially maintain their existing offering because it was a large project with a large time frame, and it wouldn't materially change the original business plan to continue to raise EB5 money now. But there's some major concerns with the fact that the old offering documents don't reflect the current reality under the new rules. Some of the material disclosures related to the type of project and those risk factors may not have changed, but the programmatic changes are significant. And the EB5 investor who invested $500,000 years ago or $900,000 after November 2019 is not the same investor who's investing $800,000 now.
Right.
There's different terms to their investments because of the changes in the EB5 rules. And so while it might be possible to continue a raise using essentially the same type of offering from before, you're going to have to do significant amendments and updates to those offering documents to account for all of the various new risk factors and new disclosures that are required because of the new rules. And I think it is exposure to some degree to have investors in the same offering who are subscribing for the same type of unit in an offering, and then have those members be in different positions based on the amount of money that they put in there and the different types of rules that they're investing under. I think it's very tricky to do that. You might be better off just doing a new offering to complement the old offering because it creates a lot more separation under the new rules from the old rules, and EB5 investors are going to be treated the same in those offerings by having a bifurcated offering.
Perhaps, but here's my worry. Say you have one particular, let's take a hotel, for example, and you had a direct pooled raise before, or even if it was a regional center raise, but it was as a preferred equity or maybe common equity. So, for example, if it was a direct pooled, it would have to be an equity raise. So now you have all right. these investors who are there expecting their money back once they get to a certain level. Then there's a new raise which comes up, and the new raise is designed or it's structured as a loan. But the loan would have a definitive amount of time. So say that loan had 5 years and that the money would be returned. There's no definitive amount of time for a preferred equity or a common equity. Could it be that the original people get pushed back, and therefore, is that an issue? I mean, I would certainly make a fuss if I was one of the older investors and I was pushed behind a newer investor who was getting a loan and getting his money back before me.
Well, sure. I think you're exactly right. And that's actually one of the risk factors of making an equity investment in a business, is that the company may decide to take on debt or other financing, which could negatively impact the ability of the equity investor to exit. Good offering documents will have disclosures related to financing in them and the potential impact of the company taking on additional financing and that having an impact on the original equity investor in the company and their ability to be repaid or to exit. So, you know, you also have to look at the corporate documents, the operating agreement or the limited partnership agreement, whatever it might be, and what are the rights of the either the general partner or the manager in that company to take on that additional debt without the consent of the other investors. It's really complicated. You have to peel these layers back and really understand what is going on a deal-by-deal basis. What did the original terms say? What was disclosed to the investor? What are the rights and obligations of the parties in the deal? And how is that going to be impacted? And look, at the end of the day, if there's a situation where the existing EB-5 investors are not comfortable with that, it very well may be the case that the documents themselves allow them to vote or veto on that. Again, it's a deal-by-deal case, and they have to understand what the terms are within those deal documents.
You're right. Again, it is a complicated issue. Coming into the office today with all the traffic, I was reminded that we are well and truly over the COVID situation in New York when there was no traffic. But I don't know about you, Sam, we're still seeing a ton of COVID issues coming into the documents. I mean, from Chapter 11 to PPP loans being used, are you still seeing them?
To a degree, I think so. I think it's more common with smaller deals or in some of the legacy pool direct deals. Certainly PPP and operating companies was a big part of the picture when those pool direct projects were popular from July 2021 to March 2022. The world was very much still talking about, you know, PPP loan forgiveness and how that would impact operations for companies. But I think we are not sure exactly what the legacy of COVID is going to be. Certainly, the rise in interest rates has been the biggest legacy of COVID right now that's impacting projects today.
Yeah.
Supply chain issues, the free cash that the government handed out with PPP that kept people with money without necessarily having to have a job. All of that has impacted interest rates rising and the threat of inflation on the economy, which has impacted EB-5 both for good and for bad. I think in a good way, it's created more demand for EB-5 because interest rates are high right now on the lending side, but also bad because I think that for EB-5, the COVID-related issues are something that we're still going to have to navigate for every business in terms of elongated construction timeframes and supply chain issues moving forward.
Well, where we've seen it really are all of the senior assisted living home projects. They really suffered under COVID. And it's not just, it wasn't just COVID itself. It was staff disruptions, getting new staff in at all. And then, of course, now the high interest rates and stuff. So we've actually started seeing it. Yeah, we've seen a couple of Chapter 11s coming in on that
especially
area.
Especially hotels. Hotels, you know, which have been such a popular asset class for EB-5, really got hammered at the height of COVID because nobody was traveling and social distancing made it socially unacceptable to fill hotels up. And we've seen some trouble in the hotel space as a result of that.
You know, during COVID, we did a special podcast where we analyzed, I think it was 14 or 15 different types of projects to see who was surviving the whole COVID period. And it really didn't matter which industry they came from. The bottom line was less debt. Any of the projects which actually had less debt survived. Anyone which had more debt. And I think that's been the history since.
Probably true, which is going to be interesting moving forward because I've seen a little bit more preferred equity than I think I may have expected to see in deals recently. And so maybe that's a legacy impact of COVID on the EB-5 market now.
Yeah. You know, Mark, it would be interesting to go back to that old episode to see how those projects are faring.
That's true. That's true. There were some that were a surprise, the countercyclical ones, right? The ones that really relied on operations and people needed things to continue to operate even when most things were closed out, and those that were based on technology did well. I wonder how they're doing.
Especially the technology ones. Yeah,
exactly.
That they've taken a hit.
Mona, do you have a lot of clients or some clients that are still sticking out from an old raise to now, still trying to raise under the same offering?
Yes.
I have a couple.
Yes,
but,
yes,
you know.
Yes. And mainly because they just stopped sort of raising capital after 2019, but they plan to redo the offering under the 1.8 rules. that we had under the regulations. And then, of course, with COVID, everything slowed down. And then, yes, they tried to raise some money under direct pooled, but we do have projects who are out there still raising capital for the same units or the same. Maybe it was a larger project and they managed to get some money and they maybe wanted to do another phase. But yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's been bad enough. It's complicated enough with the actual EB-5 provisions and the disclosure issues, et cetera. But I think with the new law, with RIA, you know, the EB-5 Reform and Integrity Act, I think we're looking at a whole new scenario because a lot of those old developers are just not understanding the depth of information required on these F and H forms.
Yeah, it's a new era, isn't it, with what the government is going to expect from the EB-5 community moving forward. And there are some significant changes. We would call these buried in the integrity provisions, right, of the Reform and Integrity Act. But these are new developments, and I think that they are largely welcome by the EB-5 community. But there's some big differences, and it's not going to be business as usual in the EB-5 space. There's some significant changes that developers and EB-5 stakeholders alike, regional centers, are going to have to take into account.
Well, here is something I really wanted to ask you about, the new rules under RIA for fund management. Because, you know, I mean, Mark, I don't know if you are aware, but SAM is very much involved with a wonderful piece of technology which really assists in all of these new fund management issues.
I was vaguely aware of that, Mona. Sam, tell us a little bit about your technology and how it solves some of the challenges brought forth by RIA.
The new Reform and Integrity Act requires fund administration in certain scenarios for projects. Prior to the passage of the RIA, fund administration was largely an optional product for most regional centers and projects. And it was something that I think was looked at as potentially best practices, but not necessarily required. And for the first time, the statute puts into effect certain requirements and under certain circumstances where a fund administrator must be involved with the flow of EB-5 capital through the project. That's a huge development. And the reason for that, I believe, really is because Grassley, for better or for worse, the senator who had a huge hand in getting the EB-5 Reform and Integrity Act passed, was a critic, a staunch critic of the black eye on EB-5, the misappropriation of funds, the presence of fraud, even if it was overplayed. And I think that that was just a part that he was just not willing to budge on with these integrity measures. And so he wanted to put into place these provisions in the law that make it mandatory under certain circumstances to have a fund administrator. That's a new development. It's a new cost to go with all the other new costs to operate in the EB-5 space. And we know for a fact that USCIS has been really keeping an eye on this. The first draft of the 956 series of forms specifically asked who your fund administrator is and who you were working with as part of the forms. So you can tell that USCIS, when they were reading the statute and trying to figure out what do they want to ask about in these forms, and they were putting together the new forms and policy, they spent a lot of time looking at that fund administration section. We've yet to really come to a point where that has been addressed specifically by USCIS. I'm hoping that in upcoming stakeholder engagement calls, we get a little bit more clarity on that specific issue, but it's definitely on their radar.
Sam, in such a scenario where we're looking at a second phase in a project, will USCIS expect fund management or disclosures, detailed disclosures for the first part of the raise, or are they really just looking at it from now onwards?
Well, I think that those provisions related to fund administration are prospective in nature, meaning that if a project is looking to raise capital under the new program, that's where the fund administration component is applicable. However, I think that if a project is going to engage a fund administrator for the new EB-5 money that they're going to raise, they might as well go back and consider doing either an audited financial statement of the prior expenditures for the project up to date, if they haven't already done so, or consider working with the fund administrator to do a true up of the previous activity in the project to date as part of a continuation of the fund administration services, which is certainly possible to do with some of the platforms that are out there.
Yeah, and if the extra capital is only used to pump up the original use of funds, that would become very apparent, which quite frankly, I know in many projects, that's what the additional money is used for.
That's right. That's right. And you can just sort of pick where you want to start with that. Obviously, you're going to start with the first EB-5 investor, but you give yourself a little bit of a clean slate. Remember that under the new rules, you also have to have a segregated bank account that's specifically reserved for the EB-5 money. Right. So if this is part two of your raise, for example, you're not really going to be using that original account that you may have used for the subscription proceeds before, or if it was commingled into an operating account at the NCE level with other money before being deployed to the project. Now you're going to have that segregated, independent EB-5 bank account that just holds those proceeds. So it would be easy, you're correct, to identify the new EB-5 money, how that's deployed into an existing project, and to track that in a silo. You know, that's not a difficult task to do.
Well, not difficult for yourself.
Well, we have, so I'm one of the founders of Proxy, which is a blockchain-based fund administration tool. Yes. That really is, I believe, a very unique product that allows fund administrators to have a go-to source of tracking the funds, how they're being deployed, what they're being spent on, and concurrently tracking the job creation associated with that spend. And it was designed to help the EB-5 industry really conform with the statute and the requirements in a best practices manner. It certainly wasn't necessarily designed to be the end-all, be-all solution for all fund administration, but we believe that the product itself has some fantastic capabilities, and we're continuing to work on it and to create more features for it. But it does provide the industry with the ability to check that box for fund administration, both on the forms and in compliance with the program, and also getting a really cool interface that they can use to leverage for marketing purposes and compliance moving forward.
Wow. Aren't you impressed, Mark?
Yeah, Mona, I am impressed. You know, with rising interest rates making EB-5 more attractive over traditional financing, but then the underlying factors that have compounded to raise those competing interest rates is obviously making the EB-5 program implementation more challenging. So thank you, Sam Newbold, for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice and sharing with us some strategies regional centers and project developers can use, specifically your new fund administration tool, which sounds like it's going to make things much easier.
Well, thanks. I'm happy to be here. Thanks, Mona, for inviting me on the podcast. And we hope so. We think that disruption is an opportunity for innovation. And so we're happy with our software, and our clients are too. We look forward to working with more people.
Rising to meet those challenges. That sounds like a solution provider.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw and Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.